From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Call me a seed nerd and I won't mind, because yes, I'm obsessed with where seed comes from and specifically how critical it is to support organic seed breeders and farmers with our seed shopping dollars. I'm also drawn to the stories of particular seeds, and not just old varieties or heirlooms, but the stories of new varieties, too. Today's guest is an organic seed breeder who likes to trace stories of seed and the seed breeders behind it. And we'll hear from her in a moment, but first this message.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
When I was scouting topics for this winter's seed series on the blog and podcast, I came across a trove of podcast interviews with organic seed breeders. It was hosted by today's guest, Rachel Haltengren, who received her master's in plant breeding and genetics from Cornell, where her work focused on bell peppers and winter squash, and on establishing priorities for organic vegetable breeding in the Northeast. She's here to talk about why organic seed matters and tell us some of her favorite seed stories. So welcome, Rachel. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me, Margaret. I'm really excited for our talk.
Yeah, I was glad to discover your work and what you were doing. And so I want to start by asking you sort of a scene-setting question, because I just said organic a bunch of times already in the first minute. And I remember asking longtime organic seed breeder John Navazio this a long time ago, but why does breeding under organic conditions, why is it so critical? I mean, why does it matter how a crop of seed was bred and then raised? What's the difference?
That's a really good question. So organic breeders are really important, and organic varieties are really important to organic farmers, people who are growing under organic conditions, because those conditions can be very different, are often very different from the conditions that conventional growers are growing under. So organically certified growers, they have a different suite of production strategies that they're using. And so varieties need to be well-tailored to those specific conditions.
Right.
So organic growers need varieties that can do well with not synthetic fertilizers, but with managing to grow with compost or other sources of nutrients. They need varieties that are adapted to growing in areas with disease pressures and insects that other growers can spray to protect the crop against.
Right. So you just used the word adapted, and that's kind of the key, is that seed's alive. It's like any living organism, adaptive. It adapts over generations to how it was raised, where it was raised, you know, and so forth. And so we want one that's well matched to our conditions. And if we're growing organically, especially if we were a farmer, you know, on a large scale, we want, and we're not going to use chemicals, and we don't have these tools in our arsenal of, you know, chemicals and so forth. We want seed that's adapted to our conditions, yes?
Yeah, that's a good point. So people who are growing under organic conditions want seed that is produced under organic conditions, but not only that, they need seed that has been selected for generations, like you just said, under organic conditions, so that the individuals that are selected are the ones that did the best under organic conditions.
Right. So I discovered via the podcast archive that I mentioned in the introduction. It was recordings of a show you created and hosted for the Open Source Seed Initiative website. The show was called Free the Seed, and I think you did the series each year, a few of them for a few years. But before you explain the show and what its goal was, maybe first tell us quickly what OSSI is, the Open Source Seed Initiative.
Yeah, the Open Source Seed Initiative is a nonprofit that's focused on education and outreach around intellectual property rights in crop plants. And so they have something called the Open Source Pledge, which is, it states that people using a variety that has been pledged as open source, they agree that they will not restrict anyone else's use of that seed, and that they expect that people using that variety for future breeding projects will also not apply for restrictive intellectual property rights on their derivative varieties also. And so they have hundreds of varieties that have been pledged as open source and a number of breeders who are working and pledging those varieties. And it's an organization that their goal, in my understanding of their goal, is to have this conversation around intellectual property rights in plants, get people talking about why we allow, as a society, we allow utility patents to be applied for and gained on varieties that are developed by breeders, and whether that's something that we as a society want, whether it's really fair and sustainable
right.
in the long term for us to have varieties that are being taken out of the commons, being taken out of being used for the public good.
Right, so these utility patents that would therefore restrict the use of those genetics in subsequent breeding projects so that the gene pool essentially of traits that are available is getting smaller and smaller because big companies have, you know, these corporations have sort of bought up, so to speak, and patented all of these traits in a way. And that's... It makes the gene pool so much narrower, and that can be dangerous. It may not be sustainable. Well, we think it probably isn't, a lot of us. So OSSI, you did this podcast for, I think, a few years, a series for them called Free the Seed. What was the goal of it? And you sort of created it and hosted it and everything. And tell us about what it did, what it aimed to do.
Yeah, so I started this podcast a few years ago, and the goal of the podcast is to hear stories about how new varieties have been developed and why they were pledged as open source.
Right.
So in each episode, I talk with a plant breeder about one specific variety. So I talk with a lettuce breeder, Frank Morton, about his variety, Hyper Red Rumple Waved, and how he decided to start breeding this vibrantly red lettuce, and hearing all of the twists and turns of its development, I thought would be a really interesting thing to listen to. I listen to a lot of podcasts myself, and I always have time for a good story.
Yes.
And so I thought it would be great to hear the stories of plant breeders and to share those stories with more people, because I thought that other people might also want to hear those stories.
Right.
And so I was really thrilled to partner with the Open Source Seed Initiative, because they have this database of varieties that have been pledged, and I thought it would be great outreach for them to have the stories of open source seed available to listeners. And so in addition to just telling good stories, the goal of this podcast has been to share with listeners who are interested in where their food comes from how varieties are developed, and to show that plant breeding can be a really accessible thing for somebody who, you know, maybe didn't study genetics in college or didn't get a master's in plant breeding, that actually you don't need those things to be a plant breeder.
Right.
you can jump right in.
Yeah.
And what I've enjoyed in all of the interviews that I've done is this sense of, I had a need, the plant breeders will tell me, or somebody told me about a need, and I wasn't sure exactly how to do it, and I hadn't done plant breeding before, but I decided to just go for it.
Yeah.
And so many times people say that they discovered things that they weren't looking for, and they had so many learning moments in the journey of developing this variety. And so I want people who listen to the podcast to hear that too, that if you have an idea for creating a variety that doesn't exist already, that you would like to see in your garden and on your plate, you can try to make it.
Yeah.
And it's an approachable process.
Yeah. Now, you don't just get results or a new variety in like a year or two or three, and especially with certain crops that have a different life cycle, and we'll talk about that in a second. But, you know, I'll give links to the past Free the Seed podcast for those who wish to listen in full. But I wanted to, you know, touch on a few highlights. Now, you just were mentioning, you know, you don't have to be professional seed breeders, and in fact, you did a a segment with the Dwarf Tomato Project, and I've interviewed Craig LaHoulier on the show as well, about this all-volunteer worldwide tomato breeding project, which is pretty wild that it has made dwarf tomato plants their specialty. So what were a couple of your takeaways from that one?
I so enjoyed getting to talk with Craig and with Petrina Nesky-Small, who was his collaborator
yes.
out in Australia. That was a delightful conversation. I personally didn't know about dwarf tomatoes as a growth type in tomatoes before I did this interview. So I learned a lot about tomato breeding. And some takeaways from that were, like you just said, the fact that this was an all-volunteer project. So they had hundreds of people who worked with them in Australia and in the United States, developing. Now they have over 100 different dwarf tomato types. And so dwarf tomatoes, your listeners are probably familiar with determinate tomatoes versus indeterminate tomatoes.
Yes.
And dwarf tomatoes, they grow like indeterminates, but they grow very slowly. And so they don't need to be pruned, and they take up a lot less space, but they have this rolling harvest like an indeterminate. And it was really, I enjoyed very much hearing from Craig and Petrina their motivation for starting the project, and that was to provide people with more options.
Yeah.
Provide gardeners with this class, entire class of tomatoes that they thought would be perfect for urban gardeners and other folks who would be able to grow them in spaces that right now it would be pretty tricky to grow tomatoes in.
Yeah.
And so they had these hundreds of people sending seeds back and forth and making observations and growing out varieties, and they discovered all sorts of things. They had all of these moments of making a cross and then growing the seeds out of that cross and finding things that they weren't expecting at all.
genetics.
So, absolutely. And,
yeah.
And so many people got to have this hands-on experience of learning about the genetics of tomatoes in a way that was meant for to be really enjoyable and meant to be fun and interactive in a community. And that's the kind of plant breeding projects that people can take part in. And you don't have to be a formally educated professional plant breeder to do it.
Yeah. I know you mentioned it closer to the start of our conversation. You did an episode with a longtime organic seed breeder that I admire so greatly, Frank Morton of Wild Garden Seed. And he and I have talked about, I had interviews in the past, and his varieties I always grow in my own garden, and he's has a specialty in salad and lettuce, and he was a longtime salad grower, he and his wife, for restaurants and so forth, and then he's sort of like looking out at these big blocks of lettuce, particular varieties of lettuce, he started to see variations in the big beds, and he thought, he had one of those aha moments, you know, and he said, oh, hey, maybe I could save the seeds from that one over there that's really different and kind of cool, and a plant breeder was born, sort of accidental plant breeder. Frank Morton became a plant breeder instead of a restaurant, you know, salad grower. So you did this interview about his hyper red rumpled waved lettuce that you talked about. And I think the part I liked best of that one that I listened to was toward the end, where he explains how breeders don't just try to make the lettuce, like in this case, redder and rumpled and waved and whatever, or the winter squash sweeter, or whatever the trade is, the tomato juicier. But they also domesticate the crop in ways, by their breeding efforts, that make the seed harvestable and easy for a seed breeder to then reproduce the crop. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about what he found out about lettuce seed. Now, lettuce is an annual, so it makes seeds every year, yes, at the end of its life.
That's
right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so Frank told a story about how he got this sort of wild variety of lettuce, so one that isn't grown very often in gardeners' gardens or in farmers' fields, but that had traits that he really wanted in a new variety of lettuce. And he crossed it to a variety that he had, and that season when the progeny of that cross was going to seed, he went to harvest it and discovered actually quite a lot of blown away already. So wild lettuce.
Oops.
Folks are familiar with dandelion flowers.
Yes.
And the way that they go to seed and seeing the seeds just puff away in the wind or when we blow them out from our when we're holding them. And lettuce, which is related to dandelion, has really similar seeds that have these little parachutes on them that will blow away when the wind comes so that the seeds can be dispersed away from the parent plant. And Frank discovered that all of the seed that he was planning to harvest, that had happened because it wasn't a domesticated lettuce. It had all of these wild genes in it. And that trait of that little parachute staying on, connected tightly to the seed, is one of the traits that lettuce breeders many generations ago selected against.
Right.
In order to save the lettuce seed, you need it to let go of that parachute and let the parachute leave, but the seed stay on the seed,
right,
on the seed head. And that same sort of selection happened in all of our domesticated crops in some ways. So with grains, the grain heads would shatter. The wild relatives of
yes,
a lot of our grains, like wheat, they will shatter when they're ready to be harvested. And so they'll fall on the ground, and it's very difficult to get grain out of the dirt. So our ancestors selected for seeds that stayed on the plants until they were able to come and pick them up.
Right.
And so there's a suite of what are called domestication traits in our crop plants that were selected for by our ancestors to make them plants that would be easier for us to cultivate and harvest.
Yes. Well, that was interesting because, you know, we know about, again, breeding for color or taste or something like that or size or whatever. But, you know, there's these other critical traits if you want to be if you want it to be a seed producing crop that you can then sell the seed of, et cetera, et cetera. So that was sort of this domestication in that manner was very interesting to me. Similarly, you did an interview with about this Dulcinea carrot. It's available from Fruition Seed, and it was bred with a team, I think, that included University of Wisconsin-Madison's Erwin Goldman and Claire Luby. And I think they, you know, carrot is a biennial, is that right? So you don't get seed the first year unless you – and they sort of set up, I think, special – environments, artificial environments, to sort of shorten the time that it takes to get seed, and lots of them. They started with 140 varieties of carrots that were sort of, you know, the ones that they were observing to maybe use genetics from and make crust from. Wow, a lot of time, a lot of work. And then what cracked me up was that, so then you want to know what's the good carrot, and so you pull them out of the ground, and again, it's a biennial, so you have to wait. You have to replant it to get the seed next year. So tell us about that, because you can't eat the whole thing, because if your best carrot that you want to get the seed from, you can't eat the whole carrot. You can't taste test too much of it, can you?
That's right, yeah. So with carrot being a biennial, the life cycle from seed to seed is that you sow the seeds in the ground the first season, and you get the carrot roots like you would pull up and
yeah,
from your garden, and then in order to get seed from that carrot, you need to plant the root back into the field in the spring and let it grow for a second season.
Right.
And that root will put up a flowering stalk and then go to seed in the second year. And so what was really special about this project is that collaboration that you mentioned between Fruition Seeds and the University of Wisconsin-Madison that allowed the project to shorten the amount of time that was necessary to get new seeds and to make those selections, such that Dulcinea came out much more quickly than it would have if those selections had just been made in the Northeast,
right,
where it would have taken 2 years to go from seed to seed.
Right.
And at the University of Wisconsin, they have winter greenhouses, and so the way that they set it up was the seeds would go to Fruition Seeds out in Naples, New York. They would grow the roots out, they would do selections, and they would taste them. And to your point, you can't taste the whole root because then you won't have anything to plant. So you can taste like a third or half of the root and then leave the top half,
yes,
for planting the next spring or, in Wisconsin, into this winter greenhouse. And so they would have the second half of its life cycle in the winter greenhouse, whereas in Naples, it would have had to be stored in a cooler over that time, and not growing that seed head. And I really enjoyed that conversation in particular because of that public plant breeding, private seed company collaboration.
Yes.
And that's another thing that I wanted to highlight in this show was the importance of the public plant breeding
of the
program.
University system, the state universities.
Land-grant universities have people who are professional plant breeders working for the public good. And I really enjoy stories of those plant breeders working closely with other breeders at seed companies and other people who are interested in becoming plant breeders.
Right.
To help train folks in creating new varieties and saving seeds of the varieties that already exist. And the role of, I enjoy hearing when those public programs at the universities are really actively doing this capacity building outside of the universities, because I think that decentralizing our plant breeding and our seed saving is something that's really critical for our resilience and for food security generally.
Yeah. So in the last couple minutes, we just have like 2-3 minutes left, and you're a super expert in bell peppers and certain squash, winter squash, I believe. And I just wonder, because we're all ordering our seeds, all of us regular gardener folks, and I'm going to start them before too long. And I wonder if in those two kinds of plants, you know, any maybe like tips, wisdoms, experiences. I mean, I've heard everything. Like years ago, people used to bury matchsticks for the phosphorus in the holes with their bell peppers, and
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I don't. You know, who knows? You know, all these conventional wisdoms and folk ideas and so forth. And you know, always start your squash on black plastic. Who knows? Any things about either one or both of those crops that you want to share with us in the last 2 minutes? Little tips?
Well, I guess I would just say that both of those crops are really easy to save seed from. And
So
if anybody is planning to grow them in their garden, they could be a great starting point for doing seed saving on your own if that's something that you haven't jumped into yet or are looking to expand in. Because both of those crops, we harvest them when the seed is mature.
Right.
You don't have to wait any longer. You don't have to wonder whether the seed will be mature when you get into it. You can just save the seed from the fruit that you're already harvesting. And if you are growing more than one variety of that crop, then you could do a little bit of work to make sure that flower only gets pollinated from the variety, from its own variety, by putting a bag over the flower of peppers, because they're self-pollinated, or by doing hand pollinations in squash, which I would recommend anyway doing some hand pollinations with squash, because there are, as your listeners probably know very well, there are two different types of flowers in squash. And so if you don't have a lot of plants of the squash in your garden, or you don't have a lot of bees visiting, you might not get a fruit from every female flower.
Right.
And so in the garden, I know I have to go out and look for the male flowers when they're open and shedding pollen and physically move the pollen onto the female flowers so that I get a good fruit set.
Yeah.
And that's something that I did quite a lot in a large field.
I bet you did.
When I was doing my master's, but it's also something that I do now on much smaller scale.
Well, Rachel Haltengren, thank you so much for taking the time. And as I said, I'll give with the transcript of the show, I'll give links to the podcast that you did with all these wonderful seed stories with seed breeders. And I appreciate your taking the time.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books and gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
And thanks to all of you for listening, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or iTunes or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.